Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a really exciting episode in front of us. You know, we have a founder that has done it a couple of times, you know, and now he's riding this rocket ship. We're going to be talking, you know, quite a bit about the pivots, you know, that they did, you know, in order to really get to this moment. Moments of absolute adrenaline with just 60 days left, you know, of runway trying to close, you know, with an investor. And then other things, you know, like, for example, how to think about enterprise, also how to raise, obviously, money. And then how to deal, you know, with competitors as well. So without further ado, we have quite an inspiring episode in front of us. Let's welcome our guest today, Vivek Sharma. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Alejandro.
So originally from India, from the north of India. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, actually, my family is South Indian from a region called Tamil Nadu in the south. But they had moved to the north to a town called Jamshedpur, where Tata Steel, my dad was a mechanical engineer working there. So was born in the north, grew up speaking Hindi, then English. Then we moved to the south where I spoke Tamil, which is a South Indian language. And fun fact, you know, Hindi and a European language like German actually have more in common than Tamil, which is a completely different linguistic root. So grew up in India for about eight till I was 8 years old. We bounced around to three different places and then moved to the U.S., my parents took a big leap, wanted a little bit more kind of opportunity, future opportunity for us, packed up a bunch of luggage, packed us up with $1,200. We headed to America, to Massachusetts, and lived with my aunt and uncle and our cousins for about probably 5 or 6 months till my dad got a job here. You know, it's been an adventure ever since. We moved around a lot in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, a typical immigrant story. I'd probably been in about nine different schools by the time I was in eighth grade. So definitely lived in a time of a lot of different change and seeing lots of different things.
That's actually kind of crazy. I mean, you know, obviously moving at eight already, you know, you have your friends, you are able to really understand what's happening around you. So that's obviously, you know, at first a culture shock, and then you're moving through like nine different schools. So it's like starting all over again, dealing all over again with that uncertainty. But I am pretty sure that that whole experience, starting with landing in the US to moving school after school, changing, making friends every time, how do you think that shaped you?
Yeah, to be clear, I hated it. You know, I hated us moving around that much. And when you think about it, it's like polar opposites. If you think of South India, both the warmth, the culture, the people, just a completely different thing. And I grew to love Massachusetts, but it was cold there, completely different culture. Back then, this was around 1984, when we moved to the US. You didn't see a lot of other people that looked like us in the area. So that was jumping around schools. You know, I'd make some friends, and then maybe 6 months later, a year later, my dad had a changing job and we moved elsewhere. So certainly hated it. You know, it wasn't a thing that I was a big fan of. And so I was really glad by the time we got to eighth grade, we settled down in one place. And I spent all of high school in a town called Pepperell, Massachusetts, in northern Mass. And so I think we just got adjusted to change. And although those things we weren't big fans of back then, now I kind of like run towards that. I need to change things up constantly, and I get bored if I'm doing the same thing over and over. So maybe it depends on where I live or what the work looks like. Or one of the things I love running a company is every year things look totally different than the year before. So sameness is something I'm not a huge fan of anymore.
I hear you. Now, in your case, you know, you obviously were graduating when the web, you know, whole web, you know, thing was exploding. And I think that also gave you some perspective, because initially you wanted to be an aerospace engineer, and then all of a sudden you realize that that's not meant for you. So how do you think that the environment around you, you know, changed your thinking or helped you in that thought process to really realize, you know, what was your path forward?
Yeah. And this might seem like a weird thing to kids going through college today. I have two boys, they're 12 and 9, and they don't know a world before an iPad and the internet and all of these things. But you know, we had a personal computer. My dad had a PC at home and he would do spreadsheets and he was an engineer. So he would do some of his drafting work and CAD software. And my brother and I would play games. You know, we download games like Karateka or Joust or, you know, all sorts of PC games. And so I took a programming class. And so this is like 89 to 93. I was in high school and I was interested in programming. It was Pascal. We learned some basic first and we learned Pascal. And my high school computer science teacher mentioned that, hey, all the important programs have kind of been written for PCs. And he wasn't really sure there was a huge job opportunity in focusing on that. So I kind of took that off the list. And I'd always been a math and science passionate about that. And entered a university called Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, which had a great engineering program. And I went in thinking I was going to be an aerospace engineer. You know, it would have been great to work on NASA, you know, NASA shuttles. And I think about a year, year and a half into it, I realized, hey, this is, my passion isn't quite here. You know, differential equations, thermodynamics, fluid mechanics, you know, this is like really intense math and engineering. And you're working within the laws of physics, kind of these physical systems. And the programming classes that I took started to get really interesting to me. And another formative thing was seeing the first web browser the first year we arrived in college. And so Mosaic was set up on all of these computers and companies were popping up, new services, Lycos, InfoSeek, you know, Yahoo showed up. And it was like, wow, this is the new frontier. This is really exciting stuff that's happening here. And I switched over into a computer science major and just kind of followed my interest, followed my curiosity, which kind of has always served me well by doing that. And eventually landed me in Silicon Valley right after college.
So then let's talk about what happened next. You know, how was it, you know, going there and how did you start there with Cisco and perhaps, you know, realizing that corporate was not as exciting as you had thought?
Yeah, I think I got my first inkling of this during university where I did a couple of internships. One was at Pratt & Whitney. They make jet engines and I was writing test software. And it was such a very different environment from being in college and it's academic and you have philosophical conversations about things and there's a dynamism to being plopped into a big company that can sometimes feel bureaucratic. You're lost in the shuffle. And Cisco was very dynamic then. I mean, they were a rocket ship. A new building was popping up on a campus every month or so. And I joined there and I was writing SNMP software that would look at network management and signals that were coming in there and put dashboards in front of users. But it was a huge company and I felt like a drop in a bucket. And I didn't know how the work I was doing was connected to what the business was really up to. And so this is a big company thing. I realized maybe I'm not fit for a big company. Maybe, is this corporate? Is this what life in the corporate world looks like? So I left. I consulted for like 3 months. And landed at a startup in the Bay Area called Blue Martini Software. The engineering team had all come from Netscape. They'd built Netscape Commerce Server. The salespeople had been at Siebel, Oracle, and it was about 20 people big. And the atmosphere was just very electric and dynamic. And you could feel that in the interview. And I'm like, I got to be a part of this. So I came in as a contractor at first. It was 20 people, joined full-time, worked on the first version, joined the core engineering team. And I think there were like six engineers at that time on the core team. We built the first version of the software, released it, and the six versions after that. And in 2.5 years, that company went from zero revenue to north of 100 million, went through one of the biggest IPOs of 2000, became a $5, $6 billion company at its peak. And it was an amazing ride to go from 20 people to 800 people in that short period of time, and probably one of the most intense work environments I've ever been in. But I learned a lot in that journey and realized, hey, there's something here, despite the intensity. This is the kind of work environment I want to be in.
What would you say were the three ingredients? Because obviously you started earlier, you were able to really see what propelled the success of the company, of Blue Martini Software. I guess, what were the three ingredients that you thought perhaps, you know, made that ride magical to get there?
Yeah, first and foremost, it was a dream team. The core engineering team, the three people, Doug, Sam, and Brian, they had worked together before as one unit at Netscape Commerce Server, and they were all brilliant in their own right, and so almost intimidatingly so. And so being a part of that, it really pushed me and the other engineers to think bigger, and there was not a lot of guidance. It was like you're thrown into the deep end of the pool, and you're going to learn, and it's going to be intense, but you'll get a lot out of it. The sales team too. So the CEO of that company, Monty Zwiebeln, had successfully had an exit before, and his first few hires were exceptional people, exceptional talent, senior leaders. So it was a been there, done that type of leader, and they built a dream team right from the start. And I credit a lot of their early success to that and having a clear strategy about how they wanted to build this company. And another fun story is that Mark Benioff was friends with Monty and had a little piece of software called Salesforce.com. And Blue Martini was the first Salesforce customer ever. And I actually had dinner with a sales rep who joked to me, he was the first rep asked to update his information on Salesforce, you know, get his stuff into Salesforce right away. So just an amazing experience, amazing pool of talent. I attribute all of the success to that.
So then after this, you know, I mean, you did the sales stint. I mean, you actually were also experiencing Japan there. One thing that you did, you know, that eventually you found that were a little bit too early was, you know, trying at it on your own as an entrepreneur. And you started, you know, perhaps a mobile social network, you know, at this point, but you realized that it was too early. So in this case, you were not able, you know, to really build an audience, and perhaps, you know, the timing of the idea was not right. So as the saying goes, you either succeed or you learn. So what was the lesson that you took away from that, you know, attempt at entrepreneurship?
Yeah, lot of lessons learned. So I ended up in Tokyo when I was at Blue Martini towards the later end of the years. And I'd learned a lot in engineering, but sales was a completely mysterious world for me. And I had no idea what salespeople did. I didn't know what a lead is or an opportunity or how deals get closed. And at some point in the future, I thought maybe I want to start a company. So unfortunately, I had no sales experience and I don't speak Japanese, but somehow the CEO took a bet on me and sent me over there to help the sales team. So I spent about 6 months in Tokyo. And one of the fascinating things was the what they call Keitai, which is the cell phones in Japan back then. In the US, the phones were mainly feature phones. You had these like no-name brands, and maybe if you were lucky, you had a Nokia smartphone or a Palm Treo. BlackBerry came a little bit later. And it was really interesting that both Japan, and then when I spent a little time in London, the phones were more advanced and you could do more interesting things. And so Friendster had already been pretty big. And so we figured there should be a mobile social network. And there weren't a whole lot of this kind of idea going on. So partnered up with a student from the MIT Media Lab. Machine learning and AI was a part of what we wanted to do from the early days. And figure out how to use Bluetooth to identify who's proximal with whom, how to facilitate interactions that are in the real world. There's all this advanced stuff that we wanted to go build, and we started building. Unfortunately, the devices there, just to go install the software, you had to go through like 7 screens of settings. It didn't work on every device. We had to do a different build on every device. So we ended up over-engineering a lot of stuff and realized we didn't know this then. We were too early to the market. Some of our bets played out in the right kind of time. Mapping APIs, geocoding APIs popped up, but other things just took a lot longer. And so it was three and a half years that we just kind of toiled away building all this code, probably over-engineering, over-building this product. And as a former engineer, that was probably my big mistake, to not keep things simpler early on. And it was just too early for what was possible in mobile. And then the iPhone came out about 6 months after we shut down the business. It was very painful at that point to realize this was not going to work. The iPhone came out, and then probably a couple of years later, those ideas would have been possible. But that became a really important lesson on market timing, about technology innovation in the future. And knowing how and when to make bets is almost as important as working on the thing.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson,
to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So eventually, you know, you ended up starting another one, and that was Market.io. And obviously, same thing, you know, it didn't unfold the way that you had hoped for. But in this case, what you did is you decided to go with a pivot. So walk us through, why didn't you do a pivot on the last company? Why did you do a pivot on this company? And eventually, you know, this ended up becoming what you're up to at Movable. So walk us through, what were the sequence of events in order for you to really make it happen and get to where you are now?
Yeah. So I did my, what I call purgatory. I was kind of hard on myself that I hadn't made the company succeed. And I thought the sales aspect is something that I had to cultivate. So I took a job doing just sales at a company, a technology company, for a couple of years. And I learned a lot in that process. And I realized, hey, I think I've got the basics down on how to sell ideas, not just build these things. And so we started this company. There was a friend of mine, Paul, in New York, who was a machine learning guy. And so that is a bit of the common thread. Machine learning has been a part of pretty much every company, every startup I've been doing since, you know, I started my career. We created a two-sided marketplace, and it was called Market.io. And the idea was pretty simple. If you're a merchant selling apparel, you're selling, you know, pants and shirts, maybe you can cross-sell merchandise from a complimentary merchant who's selling accessories like belts and shoes and have one seamless checkout. Good idea, but turned out to be way harder to execute and build this two-sided marketplace. And so we worked intensely hard on this for about 8 months and then finally realized this is going to be too hard. You know, if you've got the distribution, you've got the traffic coming to your website, there's not a lot of interest for you to go share that with other companies and bring them in and sell complimentary merchandise. And if you do, you know, that might be a new product line that you introduce yourself in the future. So we pivoted hard from that. And along that ride, this guy, Michael Nutt, joined our team like 3 or 4 months into it. And Market.io had failed. And Michael and I came up with this different idea that was focused on email. So email was really interesting to us because it's a ubiquitous communication channel. It's an open protocol. It's our digital wallet. It knows so much about us. And probably most interesting was it was not bleeding edge. Everyone was already using it. It wasn't like trying to build a mobile app in 2003. So we focused on mobile and on email rather. And one of the essential innovations early on was the ability to build email content the moment you open an email. So you're seeing something, you open up that email and it knows the time of day, it knows where you are, what device you happen to be on, and it's able to generate an image on the fly. And so we were wowed that this kind of technical thing was possible. And we came up with a bunch of use cases and we got very excited about it. And then we started digging in. Neither one of us had an email background. So I got a MailChimp account, I got a Campaign Monitor account and went entirely through the flow and realized content was really falling short in a lot of these products. So what if we could squarely focus on the content personalization aspect of email marketing? And that's what we set out to do. And we built, you know, we didn't make the same mistakes I'd made in the past. I think the first version of the product was built over a weekend. Michael's a brilliant engineer. He duct taped a solution together. I built a pitch deck over that weekend too. And we just iterated and tried to find customers. And a lot of those early customers were startups. They were, you know, a Techstars backed company or a daily deal site or a flash sales site. That was really popular, you know, about 10, 12 years ago. And the thing that we learned is sometimes we'd get these customers in, there'd be some use cases we're doing, but it was really hard to get them to part with their dollars and spend anything meaningful. And so for about a year, we kind of toiled away at this. And I think our revenue about a year into this idea was $200 a month. And so we're like, we can't build a business on this. And we were selling to the wrong customer. what we were avoiding enterprises, thinking it's going to be really hard to sell to enterprises. And so we had the right idea, but it was the wrong kind of customer. And the first time we got an enterprise deal about a year after for $12,000 to do a pilot. And then shortly after we closed a $70,000 deal, we realized, wow, there's something here. It's eclipsing what we were trying to do before. We have the right product. We just didn't have the right customer. And we doubled down, tripled down on it, and only went after enterprise from that point. And they've got these big teams and big audiences, and they've got budget to spend on things that are driving effectiveness. And that completely changed our business. And we found our initial product market fit by nailing that enterprise customer.
So for the people that are listening to Get It, what ended up being the business model of Movable? How do you guys make money?
Yep. So the core technology, what we call Studio today, our initial product, would tap into any data source that you have, whether it's an API, a CSV file. We could even turn your web page into a RESTful API and activate it and generate content from it. So it's like a composite image that forms inside your email that's unique to every single person who's a subscriber on your email list. So that really automates this idea of personalization from your own data. And the way we priced it was there was a consumption-based model. So depending on how many email opens you would think you had. And by the way, we played around with all sorts of pricing models. I do think it's really important to not only nail what the product does, but how you sell it and how it gets priced and packaged, because that can make it easy to adopt or very challenging to adopt. So what that allowed us to do, we forecast the number of email opens, and we might get one marketer using us in a couple campaigns a week initially. So it might be a smaller deal initially. They get those proof points, see that it's successful, and start to come up with other use cases and roll us out into additional campaigns within their department. Then another marketing manager might start using us. Then maybe the international division, the UK version of that brand, starts using us. And on and on. So it set up a great land and expand motion, which at the time we didn't realize. There wasn't a whole lot of information about SaaS. SaaS was very early in late 2010 when we started the company. And we were reading Jason Lemkin and Sasser and everyone kind of blogging about this stuff. But we kind of learned the stuff from first principles around build the core thing, build this land and expand motion, have those proof points. And today we've got customers who might start at $30,000, $40,000 a year, but then they end up over the year spending upwards of $1 million, sometimes several million dollars a year on Movable Inc. So it's been exciting to build up that business model and the pricing model along the same time that we're innovating on the software. So we did that with a core product. And today we've got over 400 enterprises that use us in a variety of ways, household names like we've got 20 divisions to Amazon. We have the Home Depot. We have every airline in the U.S. We have American Express. So it's a who's who list of blue chip companies. And what was also interesting about this is that we were solving a problem that the big email service providers of that time weren't solving. So ExactTarget, Responsys, Cheetah Mail, and Epsilon were falling short here. And we were the only company that was really innovating here. So we could partner with those other companies rather than go compete with them.
And how much capital have you guys raised to date?
We've raised $97 million to date.
And I know that on the Series B, there was quite an adrenaline-filled moment, when you had Intel, knocking on the door. So what happened there, when it came to a runway and perhaps, a little error there that, you guys found?
Yeah. So the $97 million is also interesting because today we are well north of $100 million in run rate. And $55 million of that was raised only a couple of years ago, back in 2022. So we've been very capital efficient through the entire life of the company. And only in this conversation is kind of occurring to me, connecting the dots to being the immigrant family here. We had to make a dollar stretch and make sure that you're getting the return on that investment and that it's worth our while. So that's built into our DNA. That's how we think about things, like really understanding what is the incremental value of a dollar we're going to invest. Early on, we got a couple of seed investors, and they've been wonderful to us. Contour Ventures was one of them. Compound is another one. Matt Gorin at Contour, Mark Michel at Compound, and John Frankel at FF Ventures did our seed round. And that was just $1.3 million. And the valuations weren't that crazy back then. So that was on a $3 million pre, was our initial round back in 2011, early 2011. And we had some success and we started to see some acceleration of the business. And we were closing revenue fast enough that we could start to hire and use our own revenue to go hire people. But then we realized there was more acceleration that we wanted to have play out. So we were looking to raise an $8 million round and had some conversations. And Intel Capital is the firm that we chose, and we got a term sheet from them. We had great conversations. And unbeknownst to me, as we were going through that process, we have a term sheet, they're going through their diligence. And Intel's got a committee that has a final look at the deal. We there was an FP&A error in the model that we had assumed we had 6 months of runway in our cash, but someone had made an error in the model, and it turned out we only had 60 days left. And this was a crazy thing to suddenly find out that if this funding didn't come through, we'd be in a pretty bad situation and unable to operate the business after a certain point. And so luckily things turned out fine. We had some conversations later on about some follow-up diligence questions, but it was all good. And you know, one of those near-death experiences that hammers into you the importance of being on top of all of the details of your company. And just because I was an engineer, just because I was thinking about sales, you really have to know every part of everything in the business. And just because you've never done it before, doesn't excuse it. You know, that's part of the job of being the CEO, of being deeply involved and being able to anticipate risk and to try to mitigate that risk and really understand what's happening in that business.
So let's talk about the now vision. So let's say you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Movable is saying, fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah. If I'm looking at the future, there's a big revolution happening in AI right now. And this is interesting for me because it connects a lot of my interest from university and thinking about machines that can think, machines that can partner with humans and do really interesting things. And today we've got an amazing enterprise customer base. You know, GPT has blown this into public consciousness. But a couple of years before, about a little more than 2 years ago, we acquired a company, an AI company called Coherent Path, and we rebranded that as DaVinci. So DaVinci is an AI-first solution, an AI-native solution that is partnering with marketers, the marketer and machine coming together, and it takes a lot of the gut feeling and intuition around running a marketing program out of the equation. So here's the machine picking out what is the right content to serve this individual. You know, where are they going in their buyer's journey, in their journey of discovery? So it behaves a little bit like a personal shopper in that regard. It's also figuring out what's the right send time for this email campaign. What's the right frequency? What's the copy that they should see? There's a whole class of AI services that we're incorporating into this. And this is a big departure from how marketing programs used to work, where people would put up a calendar and they would argue and debate, and merchandisers would want different things to show up on different days. And whoever was the loudest would often be the one who got their way into the program. And so this suddenly changes the equation. It is very data-driven, and it's finding out how to create a unique path and journey for every single customer that you're talking to. And it's been fascinating to see the insights. And when it comes down to it, the measurement of it, you know, we don't win deals unless we show incremental value to our customers, these big brands. And so the average DaVinci customer is seeing a 25% lift in revenue, higher click-through rates, lower unsubscribes. They're seeing dormant subscribers get activated again and start purchasing. So it is a completely different concept. And we're ushering in this world where I think people are going to be working with machines a lot more. And AI is going to infuse itself into the marketing department and fundamentally change how marketing gets done. And that's going to be better for the consumer because they're going to have a more tailored experience than the more generic one that they might have been served in the past.
So let's say now I was to put you into a time machine, Vivek, and I was to bring you back to that moment where you were thinking about, you know, perhaps building something of your own. And let's say you were able to stop that younger self on the tracks and give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
My advice to myself as I was starting the mobile company or every point in the future is to be ruthlessly honest with yourself about what is working and what's not working. And on a very quick cadence, every single day, you should be learning something and you should be challenging your assumptions. You should be validating your ideas. I do think ideas come from a little bit of like vision about what the future can look like, but make that tangible and start to test this out with real customers right away, because it is easy to delude yourself. And the speed with which you put these things, your ideas in front of customers, get feedback and start to refine it, is going to determine your success, because you have a limited runway. You might be able to go the distance. You might be willing to spend more than 2 years, but your team might not be willing to go make a 2 year, 3 year, 4 year commitment without seeing meaningful progress. So that honesty and knowing where you are is probably the single biggest thing. And coupled with that, a resilience. There was something Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, said recently, and as an immigrant, fellow immigrant, like it struck a chord with me, which is resilience is the most important factor that founders can have. And he didn't know how to teach it to the Stanford class that he was sitting in front of, but there's no way to get it besides pain and suffering. So he wished pain and suffering on everyone in the audience. And that rings very true to me. I think there's no easy way to go about it. You need the scar tissue to kind of get those lessons and those painful moments. And sometimes, especially for an intellectual founder, someone who's been an engineer, you need to put a different hat and be able to just punch through a wall. Sometimes it is just about tenacity and the willingness to kind of figure out, know that there's always a path, there's always a solution to whatever sticky problem that you're in. And your job is to go figure out what that is, because it is always there. It's sitting in there waiting to be discovered.
I love it. So Vivek, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out, what is the best way for them to say hi?
Yeah, I'm easy to get to. I'm vsharma@movableinc.com. I'm on LinkedIn as well, pretty easy to find over there. Definitely do connect. And you know, one of my joys is also talking to founders who are early in their journey and understanding how they're thinking about the future. And I feel energized by talking about other people's businesses, and they've got a completely fresh new perspective about the world that they're in and what they're seeing. So if I'm able to help and share some advice, I'm happy to do that. But it's a very exciting time to be a founder and a very exciting world that we live in.
Amazing. Well, hey, Vivek, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Alejandro. Thank you for the time.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.